This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballerman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballerman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 121. Brought to you in association with Smart Pension, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Cormac Leach, CEO and co-founder of Axia Funder, to discuss the very new topic of litigation crowdfunding. Once I hit the 100 episodes mark, I did wonder what new topics might come along that I hadn't already covered. But I'm pleased to say that I'm continually pleasantly surprised that mankind's creativity knows no bounds, and despite being nearly 5 years of LFPs, we have a topic we've never touched upon before. FS has for two or three decades been highly innovative, if not perhaps excessively innovative, in financialising most things under the sun. And here is a new one, litigation. And not only that, but using the peer-to-peer, you can invest in litigation. Rather bizarrely, not something I would have imagined when I was investing in stuff 30 years ago myself, professionally. Cormac was last on the show some 3 years ago when, appropriately, he was talking about innovating in P2P. Well, here we are 3 years later, and he's definitely done quite some innovation. Let's keep this intro short and sweet for a change, and find out what litigation crowdfunding is, and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Cormac. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
So, when you were on the show last time, talking about peer-to-peer, wearing your Librem hat, and I said, what do you do in your spare time in terms of starting the podcast with something not FS? You said nothing other than walking the dog. So I was so disappointed by this that sort of 3 years later, I'm still wounded. And actually, I come across with whole reams of information and interesting things to talk about if you don't have any hobbies. But you said you'd read a book recently, which is obviously a progress.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so thanks for that. Still walk the dog, but thankfully, audiobooks now in the equation as well help kid a bit with the homework. But yeah, I mean, just on the books, it was probably the most interesting topic to mention. Been reading quite a bit about the Manhattan Project recently. There's this fantastic book.
The Bomb Project.
Yeah, it's written by Richard Rhodes and is called The Making of the Atomic Bomb. And I would encourage every entrepreneur or anybody working on a challenging project to read the book, because it's a fantastic insight into what it takes to tackle a very difficult problem when you get the brightest minds in the world into a small group, provide them with unlimited funding. It just kind of takes you through all the issues they have to deal with. So it's quite inspiring, actually, for entrepreneurs.
I see. So you've learned to make your own atom bomb then, or you've learned to do impossible things?
There are parallels, right? I mean, you know, it's about kind of a minimal viable product, so, you know.
A minimal viable bomb.
Well, a minimal viable product for them was basically getting a chain reaction to happen at a very small scale. So they were literally had milligrams of uranium-235 and kind of measuring the cross-section and checking, do they have a sustainable chain reaction? And then they scaled it up quite a bit, got their nuclear bomb, and then obviously, you know, 5 or 10 years later had their hydrogen bomb. So, you know, from small beginnings, incremental thinking compounds and you can have a huge impact.
No, absolutely. And in terms of Pandora opening her box for humanity many years ago, or the humanity, I've forgotten who opened Pandora's box. Sounds like it have a different meaning these days, but it's one of the things that maybe we're better off not inventing, but actually in terms of some, thank God for large miracles, it's actually quite some miracle that more crazy idiots around the world haven't let them off in the sort of 50, 60 years since it was invented, actually.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think the flip side of that is we haven't had a world war since, because it would just be too horrific. So actually, you could make the case it's been fantastic for world peace.
Yes. I mean, there have been lots of other wars in the meantime. And one of the things that I remember about the Manhattan Project was having read Feynman's book, Feynman being such a genius, actually working on that kind of project and working out how to make the world's first atom bomb, and that wasn't challenging enough. So in his spare time, he cracked the safes, which of course had the sort of the best locks going, because that was real sort of secrets.
I was expecting Feynman to kind of make quite a big appearance in this book, but actually he gets literally, you know, about two or three lines in the book. He's kind of a two-bit kind of, you know, side part in the overall story, actually.
Oh, I see. So we had this new graduate. He was such a jerk. He just kept breaking into our locks but didn't do anything useful.
Kind of thing, yeah.
Well, he did invent quantum electrodynamics or something.
I think that was later, though, yeah.
Yes, it was a bit later when he was growing up. Surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman's quite an entertaining book. I quite enjoyed it. Although I must say, one does divide people along gender, if that still exists. Insofar as various women over the decades that I sort of lent my copy to, so I thought it was a bit of a jerk, really, but maybe it was the bit where he writes a chapter on how to chat up bar girls that they offended them. Anyway, okay, so moving on from the Manhattan Project, I didn't know whether it was before or after, then you've set up Axia Funder yourself and your own little mini Manhattan Project, not to blow up the world, but to take on a challenge of doing something new and innovative, which is never very easy. So what made you do that crazy thing?
Yeah, I do enjoy challenges. So I've kind of been a bit of a tourist around financial services. You know, I spent about 5 years in interest rate trading, 10 years in listed large cap equities, and then moved into private equity for 3 or 4 years. And now litigation, crowdfunding. So, you know, I do like to move on to new areas when I kind of feel my learning curve is kind of flattening off a little bit. In terms of, you know, what made me kind of go into litigation crowdfunding, you know, I had a personal situation where I potentially needed some litigation funding. As it happened, ultimately, I didn't need it. But, you know, I did spend 3 or 4 months looking quite aggressively at the space and ultimately sourcing some potential funding for myself. And on that journey, came across lectures in the US, because my initial reaction when I needed funding was, you know, there must be a way to crowdfund this. Couldn't find anything equivalent in Europe. And, you know, kind of the light bulb went off. There's potentially a very interesting opportunity, because when you actually look at the unit economics, you know, in peer-to-peer, you're doing well if you're getting 5 to 10% per annum. In litigation crowdfunding, risk-adjusted, you know, obviously there are very substantial risks that we should definitely touch on. But risk-adjusted, if you execute well, there's no reason why you can't deliver 20 to 40% per annum potentially to investors.
Okay, so all that is quite correct, I'm sure, and quite dense, and we'll need to sort of unpack it. For a bear of a small brain like me, let's start with the basics. I've used the phrase litigation crowdfunding, and you've used it. What is it?
It's probably intuitively obvious to folks.
I don't have much intuition, you see. I'm unimaginative.
I'm skeptical on that. But litigation funding. So you know, we're talking about commercial litigation funding. Imagine you have two parties, one of whom wants to sue the other. But the guy that wants to sue or litigate has a fantastic case, but doesn't have any money, and therefore he's unable to litigate. So, you know, people often say, you know, at the moment, to some extent, litigation is a privilege rather than a right, and it should be a right in society. So litigation funding is very simply where we provide the funding to the litigant, which enables the litigation to take place. And if the case wins, then the quid pro quo is that we get some return on our capital. So that can be either a per annum rate on our capital or some share of the ultimate settlement or the greater of two. I mean, you've got a derivatives background. You can design any payoff formula you want. But the basic principle is you get an appropriate return on your capital for providing the capital.
So just going back to absolute basic Lego blocks, I, for the sake of argument, want to sue somebody commercially. And I think I'm quite likely to win. But as you say, the law is increasingly a tool of the powerful. And so saying the law is strong on the weak and weak on the strong, which sadly gets more and more the case, even in criminal stuff, which you're not touching, it gets harder and harder to get support for yourself in this country. But anyway, in commercial litigation, I need to sue somebody. I think I'm quite likely to win. It's going to cost me, I don't know, for the sake of argument, 100 grand. I just don't have 100 grand to spend on it. So historically, I presumably would trot along to a lawyer's, a solicitor's, those what advertise no win, no fee or something, and say, hey, I've got this great case, guys. I think I'm going to win. And they hear that every day. But actually, then they look for my case and go, oh, you're one of the rare people who actually has got a good chance of winning.
Correct.
We will take it on. And so then I go there and, you know, they get their share of it. I think the closest example was actually that we were completely screwed over by EasyJet a couple of years ago. Some plane was like 5 hours late and it stopped on the way and all sorts of things it wasn't supposed to do. And because of the EU mumble around being messed around by your airline, we should have got a refund. So we filled in the EasyJet refund, da-da-da-da-da-dee. Oh, funny enough, they didn't give a shit and they came up with sort of, oh yes, but it was a Wednesday or something, sir. You know, I'm sorry about that, sir.
Right.
And so, being like most people, busy, and by then they've strung it out for months, and think, oh, fuck it, you know, move on in life kind of stuff. But that would be presumably an example where actually, and I think there actually are these services online. You can go to somebody online, they take your case against EasyJet, you know, they're used to doing it, they know all the legal tricks and all the buttons to press and yada, 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 and they get some win, and for the sake of argument, they get half the money. So that, I assume, is that marketplace in which you're innovating, which you're entering, and by decomposing it.
Yeah, I think that's right. So there are a couple of elements. So the normal kind of journey would be that, let's say that you want to litigate, you would go to your lawyer, he evaluates whether or not he thinks your case is viable, and very often he will agree to work on contingency, which we like to see because it shows the lawyer believes in your case. if the lawyer is willing to take your case and, you know, potentially do it on a contingent basis, the next step would be to get after the event insurance, because as you probably know, in the UK, the loser pays. So, you know, if you're litigating against someone and you lose the case, then you have to pay all the fees of the other side. And vice versa, if you win the case, then the other side pays your fees. But because of that dynamic, if you don't have the balance sheet to meet the cost of the other side if you lose, and if you're, for example, litigating against a large airline, you can be pretty sure they will run up pretty substantial fees, you must have after the event insurance.
And who provides this insurance then? So I'm trying to sue EasyJet to get the money back, which I know I should be getting. They're messing me around because they're a big co and they think they can. I trot along to some solicitor who said, actually, you've got quite a good case on this one. But by the way, Mike, nothing's 100% certain in this life. Do I take out the insurance or does he take out the insurance?
It's a good question. I mean, it can be structured in various ways, but typically you as the claimant would take out the insurance. And there are several providers. I mean, you know, some would be, for example, DAS or Amtrust would be a large one. But very often when you ultimately go to the capital provider, it's Hannover Re or Munich Re or one of these large reinsurance companies.
So I go along to them and I say, I've got a case for whatever it would be, I don't know, £1,000.
Let me stop you there. So you go to your lawyer. If the lawyer believes in it, then he will start the ball running. He will typically talk to an after-the-event insurance broker.
I see.
Who then will start reaching out to a panel of after-the-event insurance providers. But before that can happen, normally the after-the-event insurance provider will want to see a written opinion from a barrister, and ideally a QC, Queen's Counsel, basically going through the details of the case and the various pros and cons of the case, the merits, putting a probability on the case winning. And typically that will range, if they like the case, from 60% of the low end, let's say, up to 75% if they really like the case. Once you have that document, that arms you then to have conversations with the after-the-event insurance providers, who then will provide an amount of cover and a schedule of premiums. So the way it works is that typically they will ask you to pay a little bit of premium initially, and then if the case still hasn't settled at each of the hurdles that kind of exist in the life cycle of the case, then the premium amount kicks up until right before trial, you know, it's increased quite a lot.
I see, so that's quite complicated, really.
We haven't even mentioned ourselves yet,
no, so we
kind of enter the equation after that.
Absolutely. Well, let's just start with the sort of the basic, what the market is at the moment, and then it'll be easier to understand what you're disrupting and make sure that everybody's on the same page. So I trot along to a solicitor. A solicitor looks at my case and said, actually, I think it's quite good. In order to take it forward, he then has to give it to a barrister, who, for those people not in the UK, is the guy who actually turns up in court, by and large, and argues in front of the judge with the EasyJet's lawyer and says blah-de-blah-de-blah-de and all the sort of clever things he has to say. He, having a lot of experience in this market, makes an assessment. I'm quite surprised it's like 60 to 75. I would have thought that maybe some cases were 90%, but just kind of shows that it's not like running computer code.
The issue is that very often people say that, you know, during the disclosure and witness statements, you never quite know how people are going to perform. Also, whenever you go to actual trial, sometimes it depends which judge you get, and it depends if he's in a good mood that day. Actually, it's quite idiosyncratic in terms of predicting which way any given case will go on the day, actually.
There's clearly an example there for legal tech in the future to replace the courts. But I actually do recall some time ago seeing proper studies done on, and I think it was criminal stuff, like, you know, chance of going down for 10 years. And you definitely want to be, I think it was after lunch and not the last thing in the morning when the judge is hungry. And I'm absolutely not joking. I mean, human beings being human beings, we all know what it's like having a coffee in the morning, having had breakfast, always everything's running and you're a bit
inevitably
hungry.
They're capacity constrained and
rushed. And
I mean, they have too much going on.
I see. Anyway, so is this 60, is this kind of 60-75% chance? So that then means an insurer can price it.
The insurance company themselves will do a lot of their own due diligence, but at least gives them confidence. I mean, once they see that opinion from the barrister, that then gives them the willingness to invest the time they need to invest to understand the case. So before we'll get involved, we must have after-the-event insurance in place. So when it comes to our desk, it's already been approved effectively by a solicitor, if you like. It's been given a favorable rating by a barrister. It has been approved for insurance funding in principle, insurance cover, and then we will do due diligence on it. And if we have any uncertainties, we'll then send it out to a third-party barrister of our own choosing to do additional due diligence. And then once we think that it's an attractive case, we will provide pricing terms to the claimant and the claimant solicitor. And then that enables them to figure out what the waterfall cash flow of settlement amounts could be if the case is won. Very often our funding is on a non-recourse basis. So, you know, if the case is lost, then the cash waterfall is pretty easy to figure out.
Right, okay. So there's a lot of things in there. So just, again, going back to super basics. So crowdfunding has generally got somebody on the one hand and somebody on the other. An investor in all sorts of crowdfunding bungs his money into something in the hope of a return.
Correct. So, so far we've been talking about litigation funding just generically, which is already reasonably mature. There are various players.
Exactly. And on the other side, you've got somebody like me with a case. I've got a case against EasyJet. So we'll come on to the returns and what the people who are putting their money in can expect to get and their risks and that. But just going back to, there's an existing marketplace. Before you guys set up in the UK, there was no litigation crowdfunding.
That's not quite true. Well, let me explain. So there's lectures.com has existed in New York for, I'm going to say, 3 to 5 years. It may not be exactly right, but approximately that length of time. They've been operating as a for-profit commercial litigation funding business and performed very well for their investors. In the UK, there is a platform called Crowd Justice, which is effectively, as I understand it, a pure litigation funding, which is, say, a donation-based litigation funding, where, for example, the case... I know you didn't want to mention Brexit, but...
You're only mentioning it because you're Irish, and you've got an each-way bet. You've got an Irish passport, and have you got a British passport as well?
I don't. My daughter does, but I don't.
Oh, I see. So if we leave, then do you go?
I'll have to reapply for a residency, I think.
Oh, I see. Well, your daughter can stay and you can't.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky, yeah.
Gosh. I mean, it's absolutely... I'm just in passing. I hate Brexit by now. But it is absolutely a total political disgrace that people like you don't know what situation they're in. This could have been resolved years ago. May could have said, Britain could have said, look, anybody who is here already, you can stay.
Well, I think the Home Office has basically said you just need to do a little bit of paperwork, and I don't anticipate being kicked out, really, but never say never. But just going back to the Brexit, so there was a case, if you remember, taken to the High Court forcing the Brexit decision to go to Parliament before it could be approved. That was funded, as I understand it, by Crowd Justice. That was a campaign on Crowd Justice. So, you know, that's perhaps a good example, you know, depending whether you think it was a good event.
So that's kind of charitable stuff, yeah?
Correct.
It's a kind of charitable thing, really. It's like almost like rewards-based. You get to see government humility, so you bung a few credit. So I've got that. But just going back to my case against EasyJet, putative case. So historically speaking, before that one, and I'm sure there wouldn't be many people who would sort of fund it on a sort of charitable basis just to see me beat EasyJet. Before they existed, certainly, I would have to go along to a lawyer and that's it. So the people with the cases, from their perspective, why do they come to you and ask your funding? What's the advantage to me going to you rather than a lawyer?
So one thing we didn't mention is that there does exist a thing called legal aid in this country, where right after the war they set up this thing where, you know, the government would basically provide funding to people who had no other means. It was means tested. So if you had a great case but didn't have the funding, the government would basically fund you to take your case to court. So at the smaller end of the market where we're focused initially, it's less competitive. There's less funding available for the larger players just because the unit economics are less attractive for funders. And therefore, for many claimants, we potentially could be the only game in town, the only way for them to get funding. And then to continue the thought, we believe that our model will be more efficient because there's less cash drag. And we think actually the cost of capital from the crowd should fundamentally be lower than it is from private equity firms that have, you know, funds that are getting locked up for 5 to 10 years and also have very expensive overheads and expensive offices and so on. But that's perhaps jumping around a little bit. Would it be helpful if I kind of talk you through the basic mechanics of how the crowdfunding works?
Yes, I'm just on a very simple basis that I assume that it's very simple. If I've got money and I want to put money into it just because I want a return, I don't care what it is, but let's call it a black box, uncorrelated returns, blah, 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 and funny things like that if you're sort of hedge funds or investment managers. But anyway, basically, I'll put some money in because I want more back. Then that's actually fairly simple. Presumably there's a button with like pound sign on and I put a number of pounds and I press give it to you guys. So that's presumably straightforward. On the other side though, if I've got this case against EasyJet, is there a little box where it says click this button if you've got a case, and I type in and we were going to get this plane and how does that interface work?
Yeah, so you go to our website, axiafunder.com, and there are two buttons. There's one where you register and you can basically press a button saying I want to invest or I have a case that I would like to seek funding.
A case in UK law, in England, English law?
The majority of our cases we anticipate will be from the UK initially, but we aspire to go internationally relatively quickly. So there are two buttons. Basically, cases come to our platform, and then we have one chap on the team, Michael Lent, who has been doing commercial litigation for 30 years, assessing cases for 10 years, very experienced. He will review the case initially, decide if it has merit worth investigating further, and then, you know, depending how interesting it looks or not, we will get back to the potential claimant and progress or not.
And so how much data do people typically have to fill in to give you some idea of the case?
Initially, it can be literally 5 lines. So it can be just a summary picture, and then, you know, whether or not we need to sign an NDA, and then we get into the weeds. But ultimately, we're probably looking at close to 100 pages, depending on how complicated the case is.
And as always, as beings with some sort of frontal cortex, were using high-level abstractions like legal case. But for the little I understand of the law, there's a million types of legal case. So are there any areas you specialise in, or is it literally any legal case? I mean, you mentioned commercial, which narrows it down a start.
Our initial focus is mainly commercial. It can be commercial litigation by an individual. So, for example, if you're a minority shareholder in a company, technically it is commercial litigation, but, you know, it is with an individual. So it's a slightly grey area. But, you know, my principle, as I'm sure you will relate to, is, you know, I view each case as a bet in a casino. You know, for want of a better word. And, you know, as you'll know, when you go to Las Vegas, every time you play blackjack, the odds of winning are 49%. If we structure these cases properly, the probability of winning, we think, is 65, 70%, and the payoffs are asymmetric as well. So every time we invest a dollar, arguably, we, in our analysis, it's actually worth, you know, multiples of that. Just to continue that thought, the basic principle will be we're very open-minded in terms of what cases we'll consider.
Okay. It may well be that in 5 years' time you've ended up specialising in this or that, cases against EasyJet or you don't touch airlines or something like that. So the other parameter we haven't discussed is the kind of, as it were, the maturity of the loans. So I put some cash into your thing, it funds a case. Then going back to the subset of all legal cases out there, presumably you don't want to fund, let's say, I've got a case against Heathrow's runway expansion, which are going for about 50 years. How does that work in terms of assessing the length of a case? And do you have any sort of guidelines that you only cases less than 1 year or 2 years or 3 years or 10 years? And how does the money get tied up consequently?
It's a very good question. I mean, initially we are, you know, looking to provide amounts of funding up to £1 million. And, you know, initially, you know, for the next probably 6 months, we probably want to do cases up to £500,000. So the case you're talking about sounds like it would be many multiples of that. And for our investors, we're very much focused on IRR. So typically we'll be looking for cases that we expect will settle within 2 to 3 years. On the outside, perhaps run for 5 years, but no longer than that. Unless we have a particular group of investors who have very long-term patient capital and are willing to tie their money up for a very long period of time.
Yes, okay, so if somebody goes there tomorrow and invests in a case, it's an illiquid asset at this stage, although one can conceive, but let's not talk about too many things at the same time, in a few years of there being some secondary market, but by and large, secondary markets in an illiquid asset, you have to pay for liquidity, pay some price for the liquidity, so the money may be tied up several years. Okay, so then before we get on to the diversification point, because as you say with casinos, it's 49%, but if you know, if you structure this one so that the odds are you're going to win 60% of the time, for the sake of argument, even 51, then if you place enough bets, then the distribution of expected returns narrows, yada, yada, yada. But you mentioned at the beginning some fairly crazy sounding numbers in terms of potential returns. And obviously, before you gave up your sort of day job and came to do something as crazy as doing a startup, you will have done the math and you will have worked out to your own satisfaction that this makes sense, otherwise you would have done something else.
Yeah.
In the FX markets, you can probably get prices every microsecond these days, and you can get the last 5,000 euros of exchange rates, and you can model this and model that, and there is a public market out there, and notwithstanding the fact that sometimes FX rates sort of leap around, or we have Switzerland's and all these things, the FX market is relatively well known, and therefore, let me say, for example, that actually you weren't doing litigation crowdfunding, but somehow we're doing FX trading or FX investing, you can actually come with a high measure of confidence, and in a liquid market with a whole ton of data, and you can show me on your computer a ton of data, and you say, therefore, it's this. So what I don't know at all, one of the many things I don't know, is what the data set is that when you were sitting at home thinking, oh, I'll do litigation crowdfunding next week, oh, I better check what that's like. Where did you download the data from, and what's the data? Or is it sort of fag packet or finger in the wind or all three?
Yeah, no, very good question. So first of all, there are quite a few listed players because there have been a few IPOs recently. But in particular, Burford Capital and IMF Bentham are two large established players who have been around for, I'm going to say, at least 10 years. I think IMF Bentham has been listed for 20 years.
Sorry, are they venture capital funds?
These are listed litigation funders. And, you know, for example, with IMF Bentham in their last full year presentation results, they reported a return on invested capital on average for cases of 150%.
Per annum?
Not per annum. So most cases, I think, in their portfolio run for something like 2.5 years. You need to check the exact numbers on their website. But of that order, such that the IRRs are comfortably north of 50%, from my recollection. You need to check the exact numbers. So there are data points from listed companies. But more importantly, to my mind, there are, you know, lots of industry practitioners in London who you can simply go and meet and have coffee with and, you know, have lots of conversations. And Michael Lent, our own experienced litigation underwriter, has been doing it for 30 years. So there's a lot of anecdotal information that one can accumulate just by, you know, kind of researching the market as we've been doing kind of on and off for 2 years and full time for 1 year.
Okay, so we've got these public returns, which are exceedingly high. And then, as you say, just in terms of private network, obviously the no-win, no-fee guys have been doing the math themselves for quite a long time and working out which cases to take and whether it's worthwhile and yardy-yardy and all this kind of stuff. And obviously, as there's a marketplace there, then prima facie, that this kind of business model makes sense. Otherwise, capitalists wouldn't actually be doing it because they'd be losing their money. So then the question arises, then before we get on to the actual returns, then the question arises, what is the market failure or capacity constraint that means that these listed IF Bensons or whatever it was called are getting super normal returns for the sake of argument, an order of magnitude higher than anything else?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So it kind of perhaps is a good segue into the history of litigation funding, because this has actually been illegal for 700 years, believe it or not.
Legal or illegal?
Illegal. So, and if I can just bore you slightly with the history. So in the year 1275, the authorities that were at that point in time decided to make litigation funding illegal. And the rationale was you had barons and feudal lords who had been fighting out their disagreements on the battlefield, literally killing each other. And then the legal system was set up, and, you know, being quite aggressive chaps and willing to pull every card they could, they decided, well, okay, the new battlefield is the law court. So not only am I going to litigate against this guy, I'm going to hire 50 other guys that are going to sue him for all kinds of spurious made-up reasons. And, you know, I've got plenty of money. And it wasn't that expensive to litigate back then. So he would, he would launch 50 cases. So you can imagine his opponent suddenly gets handed. Suddenly he's the defendant in 51 legal cases. You can imagine what a nightmare that is. So the chap just has to spend the rest of his life in court. So the government decided this was actually not good for society. So they very quickly decided, you know what, this litigation funding is not permitted. That was in place for 700 years. And over that period of time, as you can imagine, the common law system, litigating became more and more expensive because there was more and more case law to review. Things got more and more complicated, such that after the Second World War, the government decided to set up a legal aid program. So the first people to actually provide litigation funding, as far as I know, in the UK recently, and this is broadly correct, maybe not exactly correct, was the UK government itself. So they started providing legal aid to folks from 1949. And then in 1967, I think the Criminal Law Act, if I'm correct, came in, which effectively made litigation funding legal.
I thought no win, no fee was a pretty recent thing, like 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, before 1967, as I understand it, you could literally go to jail for doing litigation funding. So it stopped being a criminal offence in 1967. And then there were various innovations, such as no win, no fee, contingent financing arrangements and damage-based agreements and litigation funding, which gradually started to come into the frame little by little. And litigation funding really has only come into its own around, I would say, you know, arguably sometime 2005 to 2010, which is more or less when Burford got going. So that kind of answers your question. It's quite a recent phenomenon. It's a new market such that the supply and demand between returns and capital have not quite reached equilibrium. So I think if you go, for example, if you think about reinsurance market, I bet if you go back a couple of hundred years, there were supernormal returns available in the reinsurance market, you know, insuring catastrophes and ships and what have you. And now I think the market has matured. So I think you're perhaps 10% per annum. So I think ultimately, if you fast forward 10, 20, 30 years in litigation funding, you won't get more than 10% return on your capital.
I see. Okay, well, that's quite fascinating, because I was about to say I buy what you say, but I mean, what you say is actually just talking about facts. So therefore, it's true. But in terms of, as I was saying, about financial innovation and all that kind of thing, I think that we've got more than enough history that shows that if you're a stock picker trying to decide whether BP's going to outperform Shell, there's nothing in it because you've got no inside track. You can't possibly know the things in the future.
It's a very efficient market. I mean, it can be done. It's just it's a tough way to make a living.
It's a hyper-efficient market, but investing in relatively new areas that aren't liquid and where, as you say, supply and demand hasn't balanced out yet is always a good thing. So potentially, for people investing in this at this stage, they could make good money. Although, of course, as you've clearly said, in terms of what the barristers say, it's really risky, because even if you pick the best case going, a barrister still says you've got a 1 in 4 chance of losing.
Can I add to that, actually, just talking about the risks? Yeah. It's important for people to realise that, you know, just what the risks are. So let's suppose that you are litigating against someone, and Axia, or, you know, I, let's just say I, for simplicity, decide to back you, and you lose the case, then you are liable for the cost of the other side. Now, let's suppose that you...
You don't take insurance out for me, then?
Well, let's ignore the insurance for a moment, okay? So let's suppose that you don't have insurance, and let's suppose you don't have the wherewithal to meet the other side's costs yourself. Then the judge can decide that Axia Fundura, you know, Cormac, needs to pay your litigation fees, typically only up to the amount that we have funded the case. So let's say we funded the case for £100,000, we could be liable for... So not only have we lost £100,000 of our money, but we could be liable for a further £100,000. So unless we have insurance in place, then you think you're investing £1,000, but actually you could lose £2,000. Now, if there's insurance in place, it removes that risk of going below zero, provided that the insurance pays out, which obviously is reliant on the insurance company remaining solvent, and the terms of the insurance policy not being invalidated. So, for example, there are terms and conditions about misrepresentation of data or competence of the lawyer and so on. If those conditions are not met, then the insurance company can back away from the insurance unless it's a deed of indemnity such that it's non-avoidable and they can't back away. So it's important for investors to understand that, you know, this is not, you know, an easy 30 or 40%. Actually, there are some material risks they need to be comfortable with.
I see. So... to cut a long story short, this isn't something that my mum, 84, whatever she is now, should be putting her money in. It is a sophisticated, relatively new proposition, which promises supernormal returns, but you presumably want a class of investors who are prepared to put a bit of homework in and understand all the things that you're talking
Correct.
About.
So we're targeting high net worth investors and sophisticated investors who have substantial experience in the city or have made many private equity investments previously. And I should say, people who have passed an appropriateness questionnaire. So we, before people can invest, they have to answer 10 questions. If they don't get all of them correct, then we don't let them come on the platform. So it's important that people understand the risk before they get involved.
Yes, and it seems to me more complex risk to evaluate than, as it were, investing in a startup on Crowdcube, because any idiot knows you put your money in something, the startup may go bust, you lose the lot. That's simple. In yours, it's more complex. So it also occurs to me, and it will have no doubt occurred to you, that it sounds like that it's also a kind of a sexy asset being non-correlated, apart from the last four hedge funds who've got loads of clever clogs sitting around with nothing better to do than spend sort of days talking to you and working it all out. Are you going for just sophisticated retail money, or are you going to go for institutional capital as well? Or is it sort of, you've got various phases of how you're going to grow?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're open-minded and, you know, open to all forms of capital within reason, provided that the investors understand their risk. I think just from my own experience, my expectation would be that hedge funds and larger private equity firms probably wouldn't want to engage with us until we can demonstrate some track record and we can also demonstrate that we can deploy sufficient amount of money such that it moves the needle for them, that it's big enough for them.
Yes, that's obviously a capacity thing. I mean, vice versa. The other thing that you could end up doing is white labelling. If some hedge fund launches a sort of a sub-fund or a fund called a litigation fund with 100 million in or whatever, we've got a minor problem of cash drag because you couldn't spend 100 million tomorrow for capacity reasons. But anyway, that's a business model. Okay, so before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all you listeners out there. I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, and I'd particularly like to thank Blue Motor Finance, who are stepping down, having been around for 18 months. Thank you very much, and so long for all thanks for all the fish. And Smart Pension, who are far secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. And talking about not having done my homework, I've been spending far too long on the book, and so it's been very remiss of me that most fintechs have to do a funding round about every 12 or 14 months or something, and I should have been doing my funding round last quarter in terms of shaking the trees and getting some new brand partners, but I haven't had time. Anyway, good luck to Smart Pension, as you're now the sole sponsors. And if your name here fits and your blue chip, then ping me and maybe we can chat about putting you on the co-sponsor list. So we've got this far, Cormac. We've certainly mentioned Axia Funding once or twice and what you're doing, and you had a pretty good excuse, as you're the only kind of crowdfunder in this context going, so you are the only example. What messages would you like to round up by telling the listeners out there?
Yeah, I'd like to kind of flag three things, if I may. The first is, we get asked sometimes by venture capitalists, is Axia Funder scalable? You know, to some extent, it can look a little bit like a cottage industry because, you know, cases come in, you assess them and you fund them. We actually have an exciting plan that we would like to implement whereby we set up a case assessment portal, which we then make available to lawyers all over the UK who have passed our kind of accreditation process. And that enables us to scale what we're doing such that we could start to assess hundreds of cases per month rather than, you know, a small number. But of course, we need to raise equity finance to do that. So that's kind of one thing that I'd be interested in discussing with anybody who's interested in getting in touch. Second thing is, of course, if people have interesting cases they would like to litigate but lack the funds, please do get in touch. And then lastly, we are about to launch a new case which is IF ISA eligible. So the case that we've done so far is an equity investment which was targeting a return of 60%.
16 or 60?
60. 60. Targeted 60% return if this case
gross
succeeds.
Return or IRR.
That is a simple interest return, net of fees. But the next case we're planning to do will be a bond, which will be IF ISA eligible, and it will have a return per annum on a simple interest basis of above 70%, we think around 75%. So of course, if people are interested in what we're doing, I would encourage them to register on axiafunder.com as investors, and it would be great to get them involved.
Yes, if you're sophisticated and don't mind gambling on a deal, it sounds quite fascinating. And I think you were saying before, and suddenly occurs to me hearing you now, that if you're going out there and saying we can make 7% return or 10% return, that's kind of in the bounds of credibility and people think, oh, that's okay. But I know you've got a good reputation, you've been around some time. But for people who might not know you, the idea that I've got this great investment that's going to make you 70%, sir, is presumably makes a few people go, you what?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Does it not lead to kind of, this must be too good to be true and therefore it's false?
I think that's right. But I think if people look into the details, I mean, for example, we typically provide 30 or 40 page offer document for each thing we're doing. If people look into the details, they see how it works. But absolutely, I mean, when people see the headline numbers, their eyes glaze over and they assume it can't be true. The important thing to mention is it's not without risk. So people need to understand that, you know, the quid pro quo is that there are some large substantial risks that go along with that return.
Yes, we were talking before about when I set up my own tech fintech 20 years ago, well, before these things existed, I stumbled into the fact that I was doing something that I'd never done before and which is rarely done, which is called evangelical selling. Most time people are just selling a better motor car, a different flavour of ice cream, and you turn up and you say, oh, I'm a peer-to-peer, we do lending and borrowing online. And you go, oh, I go, oh yeah, I know what one of them is, so why are you better than the current ones? Which is what everybody thinks of as selling. It's a very rare case, which is actually what you're doing and what I did back in the day. It's a very rare case that you're going out there selling a new category which doesn't exist at all, which is why it's called evangelical selling, because you go along and you promote the idea of gospels and you promote the idea of Jesus and all this kind of stuff. And that takes quite a long time to explain.
And we have the benefit, we can make the argument that this is clearly socially useful because you're helping to make access to the legal system easier. You know?
Exactly. So there's a long explanation required about what it all is in the first place. The big hump to get over is, as it were, for people to buy into the concept. Having bought into the concept of what I was doing 20 years ago or what you're doing now, they go, oh, okay, yeah, no, I think that's cool. Who can I go to buy it from? Does every shop on the high street sell it? Oh, no, it's only me. So the actual sale bit is very easy. It's just actually explaining all of this complex stuff that takes all the time.
No, I think
so
that's right.
I think the corollary of this is that it may take longer to build momentum than you want. Everything takes longer than you expect. But I suspect that once you have got momentum, it's the kind of thing that could grow very rapidly. Once you've got a few deals, once you've got a track record, and you say, well, our 3-year track record is so-and-so, and people go, oh, blimey, and then some hedge fund comes along and says, okay, look, how do you do 100 million?
I mean, the easy way to do that is we just hire some people that have, a demonstrable track record of 5 or 10 years doing this.
Yes, scaling always looks easy. Right, good. Okay, well, that's been very fascinating, Cormac. As I say, it's interesting with hindsight that we were talking 3 years ago about innovation in peer-to-peer. Peer-to-peer hasn't been doing much innovation for some time, but this certainly is an innovation. I doubt that many people listening to the show today will have heard of this one. And as I say, it is very fascinating that creativity never stops. So I wish you every success in the future, and I shall go to your website and type in EasyJet and see what comes up. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
curtain and I've been there all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so gray, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.